Let's talk. John Brown.
The mere name of Ebola can spike terror into entire countries and communities, as we have seen over the past couple of months. But what's been more surprising, perhaps shocking from a Western perspective, is the violence that has accompanied this outbreak. One man who brings this perspective and experience to it is Dr. Tyler Evans. He's the CEO of Wellness Equity Alliance, and he joins me live on the line now. Dr. Evans, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Whereabouts do we find you, brother? Where are you based?
California, Bay Area.
Very nice part of the world too, and an awfully long way away from what we're seeing at the moment in Africa. Explain to the listeners, firstly, what Wellness Equity Alliance is and what your experiences is of this particular disease.
Sure. So Wellness Equity Alliance is a public healthcare alliance focusing on essentially the most innovative clinical service delivery models for the most historically marginalized communities. You can kind of think of us as public health as the sort of the tree trunk, and then the branches are street medicine, which is providing direct clinical services to the unsheltered and housed, tribal health, rural health, and behavioral health. And we also have some programs in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, focusing on the survivors of sexual gender-based violence.
And you have come across this. I mean, can you just briefly explain what Ebola is? Because I think we know, obviously, it's horrendous, but we don't know the ins. It's extremely infectious. It's extremely fast moving, and that is what is so terrible about it.
It is. So Ebola is it's an RNA virus. Essentially, it is spread through zoonotic transmission. That means animal to human. Bats are the reservoir. And so we typically see this in rural. We see outbreaks taking place in rural areas for the most part. First outbreak took place in the 1970s. We typically have seen them in Uganda, in Sudan, and sort of Central Africa. The most common strains are referred to as the Sudan or the Zaire strain. And Zaire historically was the Democratic Republic of Congo before, so you can understand the certain geographical correlation there. And in terms of symptoms, there's basically three different sort of stages. The first is the sort of flu-like stage where you get a really high-grade fever, muscle aches, fatigue. Second stage is going to be your gastrointestinal symptoms. And then the third are the hemorrhagic component where you start to sort of bleed out. The case fatality rate really depends on the strain, but can vary anywhere between 10 to north of 50%. The current strain, which is the Bundibunja strain, is much higher lethality, somewhere between 25 to 50%. The problem is you don't really have a lot of data points on these things because people tend to, when they get sick, the case fatality rate is so high, and it's usually in these rural areas, that it basically burns out really quickly. And so either people get sick and they survive or they die. So in terms of spreading, the I know this sounds odd from an epidemiological standpoint, but it doesn't spread as effectively as kind of your respiratory illnesses because a lot of people are asymptomatic with them. They can sort of, the incubation period can be a little bit longer, and they're spreading it sometimes without sort of knowing it, and they're also, you know, surviving. Because this impacts the person so profoundly, it's very hard for them to be sort of, you know, interactive with other humans. Also, remember, it's rural for the most part, so the spread to urban environments generally does not occur. And then, in terms of the highest risk of transmission, it's after after you pass away. It's the first 48 hours after death. So during funerals, that's historically has been a very sort of high risk time. And of course, people want to bury their loved ones, you know, with grace and dignity. And so not being able to do that is a serious concern.
You see, this is one of the things I was going to ask, and it might sound a bit sort of brutal, but if it's in rural areas and it's so quick, it's going to rip through the rural area before it sort of hits an urban area, as opposed to like the pandemic that we all went through, which obviously was respiratory, and it was taking place in rural urban areas. That might sound a bit harsh. However, one of the things that perhaps if you're watching your news feeds and you know, a lot of us in Europe and the States do not have an idea of Africa. We think of Africa as one big landmass and they do things differently over there. And seeing and reading reports of violence towards health professionals, of, you know, funeral coffins being snatched, you know, it seems to us unbelievable. What are these people doing? You know, what is going through their minds? And we are obviously thinking, well, these people don't know how dangerous this is. You've got a different point of view because you have been kind of there twice with two previous outbreaks, and you've seen the same sort of thing happening. Explain a little bit, please.
So for context, like I said, there's been, several outbreaks, but, you know, typically these outbreaks are relatively small and contained because they're in rural settings. You know, typically there's no more than a few dozen people that may die. This is the third time that the WHO has identified this as the public health emergency of international concern. So that's not exactly a pandemic yet, but it's basically the step below a pandemic. So this is really serious. I mean, this is the first one was 2014, 2016, West African one, very well known. I was working on that one in Sierra Leone. The second one was in Congo, in DRC, in 2018, 2019. I also worked on that one. And this is the third one. Now, I think this may be the worst one to come. And there's really six reasons why I think that is. And I'm happy to explain what those six are.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, though, is obviously we talk about public health and we think from a European standpoint or from an American standpoint. I mean, what's the public health system like to begin with? And can they handle something like this would be the first thing.
That's part of the six. Yeah. So number one, basically the tests, the diagnostic tests, the point of care tests, that we often use for Ebola, do not work effectively for this strain. Because again, the Sudan and the Zaire strain are, you know, about 95% of representation. So while we can use what's called molecular, based, test or PCR tests, that actually picks up the viral strain. Those are expensive and we can't sort of roll those out sort of, you know, in the fields. So we lost weeks, in terms of understanding whether or not people actually had it because they were not laboratory confirmed. So that's number one. Number two, we don't have therapeutics or vaccines for this current strain. We're still testing to see sort of how effective the prior vaccinations were. I was vaccinated during a clinical trial at NIH for the last one. They were quite effective, but for this one, we don't believe that it will be that effective at all. So now we have to create a new vaccination that we need time for that when we don't have therapeutics or treatment. Number three, conflict. This is the most conflicted nation, arguably, in the world. Like I said before, I've been working on a project there ever since 2018. In terms of if you just look at UN involvement, the number of UN personnel and expense of UN, it is the most expensive UN mission around the world. If you take away sort of active wars like Ukraine and Gaza. And so this is we have a situation where you've got constant rebel groups coming in. This is all, you know, this was all sort of precipitated by the 1994 Rwanda genocide and this sort of spillover from Rwanda into DRC. And I mean, it really preceded that, but, you know, it really sort of scaled after that. So you've got all these rebel groups that are constantly coming in. You have people that don't trust the government, don't trust the rebel groups. And so when you have all of this insecurity, you have something that I refer to in my book, Pandemics, Poverty, and Politics, as population stress. So you have this sort of this sort of tenuous infrastructure of public health. You have this sort of you have this from a viral standpoint. You have these viruses that sort of are emerging, and it goes from sort of like a latent sort of component to active as the result of this pressure cooker scenario of all of this sort of sociopolitical insecurity, of all this infighting and whatnot. We saw exactly this happen in the West Africa outbreak in 2014, 2016. What happened there? There were decades of war that preceded that in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And we saw that also with HIV in during the apartheid times, and the rise out of apartheid in the 1990s. Number four, infrastructure. The infrastructure in DRC, public health infrastructure, is one of the worst in the world, partly because of these sociopolitical insecurities. And then you basically add additional sort of exacerbating components, because the U.S. Has helped these areas for years, for decades, but because we pulled out of USAID was essentially disbanded, because we pulled out of the WHO, because we pulled back tens of millions of dollars in grant funding for this area, basically any sort of support that was, any infrastructure that was there, was sort of taken away. So that's made this situation profoundly worse. Number five is urban involvement, as I was saying before. The fact that this is now in three major African cities, these are highly concentrated cities. You're talking about Kinshasa, Kampala, and Goma. These are, areas where people are living in multi-generational homes, several people living in sort of, in small units. And so the ability for that contact to take place is much higher. So that's a major concern. And the final piece here is trust. There is no trust among the community members and the government for the reasons that I explained before. And so when you have community health workers that are trying to kind of engage these folks and help them and test them and whatnot, they will not go with them because they do not trust them. They think that this is some government plot. Think about, like, there's these white tents that we stand up. We call them ETUs, Ebola treatment units. And, many people go into these things and based upon the case fatality rate, half of them are not coming out, right? So that does not appear to be a safe place for them. So we believe that a lot of people will not be seeking healthcare. And so they're hiding out, infecting other people as a result. So the numbers that are currently being reported, we do not have a lot of confidence that those are sort of accurate. So it's really created this perfect storm of conditions here. And, we really think that this is going to scale way beyond Uganda and DRC. And then the final thing I'll say is we got World Cup here in the US. I just went to a few games. And so, this is with all those other conditions, if this were to get in with all the travelers coming in, it's,
yeah. I mean, I was slightly concerned before this interview, Tyler, and now I'm even more concerned for a couple of reasons. One, I wasn't aware that it hit the major African hubs like Kinshasa, because we're talking about international hubs there. But the other thing is the fact when the US pulled the aid out, and it was like, okay, so we're not going to let, it was strange. It was, oh, we're not going to let them become trans kids or something really facile. And, a lot of my friends work in South America as well. And they were like, this is creating a real pain, a difficult situation for us, because we don't have we don't have the infrastructure to do this. And this is a short term, this is going to disrupt our long term aim. And in terms of long term, the point about people coming in, and this isn't going to sound facile, Tyler, but if they come in with the whole ET setup, i.e., the outfits, the tunnels, which they need, and disappear, and you're putting this on a population who don't know these people, this can be seen as almost an invasion. Or, as I said, they go into these tents, they don't come out. Presumably, you need people in the community, but you can't finance people in the community because you've got no budget for it.
Right. That's right. Yep. It's the worst possible scenario. But here's the thing. This is not an isolated incident, right? We are seeing this take place across the world. We're certainly seeing this take place in the US. And again, this is my book talks all about this. This pandemics, poverty, and politics. Basically, I take all of the pandemics and some of these public health emergencies of international concern, like the 2014-2016 Ebola outbreaks, and I essentially kind of outline all of the socio-political kind of drivers or influences that impacted these pandemics, including the Spanish flu, all the major sort of flu pandemics, Ebola, HIV, plague, cholera. All of these sort of pandemics were the result of not having foundations or infrastructures in place that really allowed to address that address the sort of the social inequalities that sort of exist. And if we don't have that, these pandemics and these outbreaks will continue to take place. And those outbreaks will scale from epidemics to pandemics. The infrastructure is absolutely essential. And right now in the U.S., not a European problem per se, European sort of CDC is much more effective than ours right now. I mean, ours is pretty much gone. But it's a real problem across the world. It's not just an American problem. It's not an African problem. You know, we don't have the appropriate public health infrastructure. We're not working together effectively. WHO is the best thing that we have, and now US is pulling out. So this is, we're really going to have to come back to the table and rebuild these public health systems because.
But people were saying, oh, but we have research. I do my own research. I don't trust big government, big pharma. Right. You know, Fauci is in league with the Kabul of whatever. But you can't, presumably you can't suddenly hit people with a tsunami of information going, no, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. You've got to gently feed this information to people so they have time. Because a lot of people, I think, were rowing back on, especially during the pandemic, who didn't want to get a vaccine or something like that, were going, all this information came out. They're not used to dealing with medical professionals. So they went to the standby. Well, we don't trust it. We've seen what's happened before. You know, in the UK was thalidomide or other things like that. And they can kind of join the dots in a very interesting way, but joins the dots they did. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, is it an idea to keep informing people of what's going on rather than if something happens, just to hit them with a huge amount of information without a backup. That's what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Yeah. I think the foundations need to exist. Number one. Number two, the foundations of sort of science need to be connected to trusted messengers, right? We're in this really weird space of mis and disinformation. And, you know, part of it is sort of potentiated by these echo chambers. The AI, internet in general, but then AI, it's, you know, these got the Dr. Googles and all that, you know, people need to, and we're also kind of on this sort of attack of expertise in today's world. You know, people say, oh, I don't need, you know, the Fauci's and all that. I can figure this out on my own. Right. And the reality is, it's just not true. We need the experts, but we need the experts in place, but we need the messengers that can translate to the communities that trust them. Right. That's what's missing. And during blue skies, that's important. During gray skies, it's critical. Right. Because people are going to get their information from different sources. And we need to ensure that the sources in which they are getting are connected to truth and reality. And if they're not, it's just going to spiral and it really gets weird. Right now there are in the U.S., you know, there's this sort of this abandonment from sort of like, again, the scientific principle. There's this attack on science. You know, who knew that science would be this sort of like this sort of triggering, you know, word. But it is where it is.
As a professional who's looking across then at the moment, I know that you're busy, so this will be the last question. But looking at what's happening, you described the whole situation as these 6 points of a pressure cooker. You've got warlords coming in and out. They don't care about the people. They're grabbing whatever they can. They don't probably even know what the disease is until it's too late. You've got the population who are being displaced and they're fleeing wherever they can. It's spreading. I've heard reports of like medical centers with not enough water to even wash medical professionals' hands, never alone, you know, treat people. And as we said before, now it's heading into major population hubs. How concerned are you and how concerned should we be? But in a way that we don't all say run around doing literally the sky is falling in or we shut everything down or you're seeing what I'm saying. How concerned should we be about this particular strain and the situation we find ourselves in at the moment?
I would say in terms of, I like to, as a physician scientist, I like to quantify everything. So I say from a scale of 0 to 10, I would say in terms of the African, sub-Saharan African continent, I would, my concerns at a level 7. In terms of my concern sort of globally beyond the African continent, I'd probably be at a level 4 right now. That could, if we could contain this, you know, we could sort of, you know, reduce or mitigate that number down to, you know, to a 2 or 3. But again, with this pressure cooker scenario, I don't think that's likely. And I was talking mostly about DRC. Uganda has some real issues as well. You know, their public health infrastructure is much better. In fact, they've done really, really great things when it comes to HIV. But I just gave a talk out there right before the outbreak took place at Makerere University, which is in Kampala. And they were talking about lack of trust with public health emergency preparedness or pandemic preparedness. So this is really, this is a systemic issue. And so Uganda's got some real challenges as well. So I'm not an alarmist. I know that doesn't seem that way in this conversation. I'm really not an alarmist. I'm actually very sort of risk tolerant. But again, this has all the conditions to really kind of explode in scale. And I really hope I'm wrong. But I do think people need to be prepared. Folks need to be informed. They don't need to do anything right now outside of the, you know, the areas that are currently impacted. But they do need to ensure that they're getting the right information from the right sources. And so that if there is anything that does take place, then they are ultimately prepared. And then we will, you know, respond to the actual sort of, you know, areas that are being impacted. But one of the, you know, this happens, this, I get this question often, what can I do to prepare? Right now, again, be informed. That's the main piece. I would say hand hygiene is always something that we could do, you know, when we're doing infection prevention control. That's a good preparation.
As my mother used to say, wash your hands. The book, by the way, is Pandemics, Poverty and Politics. It will be available on our own virtual bookstore if you want to have a look, listeners. If people want to find out more about the Wellness Equity Alliance and what you're doing, presumably websites, social media, where can they find you?
Sure. Yeah. WellnessEquityAlliance.com. We also have my own website, TylerBEvansMD.com. And then the book is on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. So you can check it out there as well.
Well, listen, thank you for taking the time to speak to me. I'm not quite yet, you know, you've given me the information I need. I will sleep maybe a little easier tonight, but it's an interesting subject. And thank you for bringing some of the points up. Dr. Tyler Evans, CEO of Wellness Equity Alliance. Thank you for your time today.
Great to be here.